Judy?
Thank you.
Knowledge economy.
Thank you. I'm going to. I'd like to, as Fritz Attaway and Carrie Sherman ask, I'd like to know if it's okay if I submit a written version of this as well. Thank you.
You might tell us who you are.
I'm sorry. I'm James Love. I go by Jamie. I'm the director of a nonprofit organization called Knowledge Ecology International. I'm also the U.S. co-chair of the Transatlantic Consumer Dialogue Committee on Intellectual Property. And my background's in economics, not in law. Because I'm talking about some legal issues, I don't want to overstate my expertise in that area.
Economist and lawyer.
I'm definitely not a lawyer. So the first issue point I wanted to make is on transparency, and that is that I think it's desirable to have more transparency and available data on the resource flows, investments, wages and incomes, and prices in the copyright system. Policy should be guided by evidence and analysis, and the committee should examine the evidence base to see what can and cannot be improved. Not just report on what it's possible to say from the existing norms regarding transparency and data collection, but to consider whether or not it's timely and important and useful to change those norms. Number two, not all limitations and exceptions in copyright are subject to the three-step test. And that's something that is often kind of blurred in these discussions. First of all, not all rights in the three-step test, not all rights in the Berne Convention are subject to the three-step test. The author's right, for example, is not subject to the three-step test. It's a mandatory exception. And some educational exceptions are not subject to the three-step test in the Berne Convention. There are some rights in the appendix to the Berne Convention, which are definitely not subject to the three-step test. And there are related rights, which are not protected by the Berne, in some countries are really related to the Rome Convention, which are treated differently. The exceptions to the remedies are not covered by the Berne. The Berne is almost silent on the remedies. So some of the important limitations and exceptions in U.S. law are done through the remedies part of our copyright law as opposed to the rights themselves. The rights exist, but you may be a limitation on the remedy for infringement of that right. Those are generally not subject to the three-step test. In fact, in an important provision in the TRIPS is Article 44, 2, 1 and 2 of the TRIPS, which deal with the injunction, in one case the waiver of injunctions in 44, 2 of the TRIPS, which is not subject to the three-step test. And in fact, our government use statutes for copyright are based upon Article 44, 2 of the TRIPS, not the three-step test, as a specific example. Anti-competitive conduct is not subject to the three-step test. The first sale doctrine, which is protected by Article 6 of the TRIPS, not subject to the three-step test. I could go on, but I just want to say that the three-step test is really a core and important idea. It's very important in terms of the rights that are granted. It's not a central issue in the remedies to those rights in these agreements, including the new ACTA text. And you just have to think about that as you fashion your proposals. You have more flexibility on the limitations and remedies, it turns out, than you have on the limitations on the rights themselves under the WTO environment. Number three. Formalities. Well, we agree, and I think a lot of other people do, with the comments by Carrie Sherman of the RIA and by Professor Carroll on this point, that we need to move more toward an opt-in rather than an opt-out approach. And I would like to mention that in the context of formalities or registration requirements or different things that might be fashioned in that area, that The binding, one problem you've got is what the TRIPS says. And the TRIPS on formalities is really, the TRIPS requirements on, it's related to the copyright term partly. The TRIPS says a 25-year term for copyright, the United States has a much longer term for, on photographs. There's 25 in the TRIPS. It's like super long in U.S. law. For that period past 25, it's our position, and the position of many experts, the U.S. could introduce a completely different regime for the period after the first 25 years of photographs. And that's the same story can be told in copyright work. So one issue you have is once you exceed the life plus 50 for a literary work or 25 years after a photograph or something like that, what can you do? The same thing is true with the Rome Convention, where you have shorter terms for certain kinds of rights. And also, the Rome is also not like the Berne as it comes to formalities. Now, even though we didn't sign the Rome, some of the rights found in our copyright law are not required by the Berne Convention, but come out of more of the tradition of the related rights regime, can be dealt with in formalities in a different way. I sort of got interested in this when a lobbyist for the European broadcasters in a WIPO meeting was talking about copyright in Europe on the sound of water dripping out of a faucet. And he was in the business of people that are trying to put together multimedia works. And he felt that it would be a helpful thing from the point of view of the broadcasters if more works of that nature were not protected automatically by copyright. And he didn't think they really fell under the Berne. He felt those kind of particular copyrighted things sort of fell under the realm of the Rome, which he drew my attention to the fact did not have a prohibition on the use of formalities. Number four, one size fits all. Well, I think that the aesthetic appeal of a unitary system of intellectual property is in conflict with the practical needs of creative communities and the users of those works. Number five, I'd say that goes both within the differences, the way you want to implement a copyright within the copyright system, and the differences between the copyright system and the patent system or other forms of intellectual property. This sort of non-discrimination language that you find in the current draft of the ACTA agreement or in the TRIPS agreement in some provisions or some areas of intellectual property laws, the idea of putting intellectual property is one thing. It's not a helpful approach. I think that anything that sort of leans the other direction and articulates basically the public policy rationale for not going down that road would be good. Is that a cat? Sorry. Or a comment. No, that's a cat. Okay. Five, right to get control versus right to get paid. I agree with those that said before, and we're very articulate about the fact that there are certain areas we should move towards systems where the right owners do not have control over the use of the works, but they have a right to get paid. And the challenge is typically setting remuneration in these kind of situations. And I would argue that the value of the exclusive rights regime is not that the outcomes are particularly great, although in some areas they probably are very good. But it's just that you have a legitimacy of the willing buyer, willing seller that kind of keeps people relaxed about it. And I think that's something to think about in the remuneration thing, because often there's a real challenge in coming up with a methodology that you can defend across all the cases where it's going to be used. And it's going to be quite visibly arbitrary in some areas. So an alternative approach that some people have explored in the area of setting remuneration is to identify people who have legitimacy to make the decisions about compensation and not to tell them how to actually make those valuations, but create a system that people are comfortable with in terms of the people making the valuation in the first place. I would say that in general that you have kind of a philosophy in remuneration. One is to replicate market outcomes. And this more or less deals with trying to reduce transaction costs. An example of this would be like the extended market licensing approaches in Northern Europe, which I think should be taken a look at as relates to possible application in the United States more, particularly in the education sector. In other areas, the replicate market outcome is not really very appropriate. And the reasons for dissatisfaction with a replicate market outcome rule is that it may be hard to approximate a market outcome in some areas because of the heterogeneous nature of the works that you're talking about. In other cases, the market income itself may be socially inappropriate, inefficient, or not optimal in some other way. One example in music is the so-called Britney effect, and that would be it refers to the situation of super incomes for a handful of superstars and poor outcomes for the less famous performers. And there are some people that suggested models to flatten the distribution of income curves for artists or to share rewards with some, with those whose influences and contributions were important. A different approach would be to create a systems of competitive intermediaries operating under certain mandates, but with discretion and valuation and values and philosophies and things, where you would allow people to pay their remuneration fee to a group that chose a different income distribution or a different set of criteria for who to evaluate than something that would just replicate a retail transaction. One such model of that in the music would be the Blur Banff model, which I worked on with a group of artists in Banff, Canada, and a workshop at NYU some years ago, or at the New School, rather. Number six, a supply of knowledge is a public good. Well, I think that the committee has to, I mean, there's a lot of interest, as you know, in moving certain kinds of knowledge goods into kind of a public good status. So IBM has been quite famously has said that, you know, they came to the conclusion that knowledge is often more useful if it's more widely shared. The problem is, how do you reconcile the sustainable economic model for creating the good in the first place with the idea that you essentially create a zero marginal cost for the work? And I think that's something that requires a kind of an adult conversation about how you pay for things. Now, some of the models that I think have been promising is would be agreements or mandates that these are sort of competitive and decentralized models of funding, where libraries spend a certain amount of their money to build up public domain collections. Like, for example, subsidized libraries have an obligation to spend part of their budget to buy books, to buy the rights for books to put into free public domain digital libraries. So the authors would be paid by the libraries. The libraries would build the collections. And it would be, it's collectively in every library's interest to do this. But for each individual library, it just doesn't make sense because they're putting up the money when everybody has access. But if all the libraries have essentially the same obligation, they collectively begin to use their procurement power to not only buy books for their private collection, but the taxpayers who pay for it would say, we'd like part of those collections to be part of a global thing in a completely market transaction, so that you have money, you go out in the open market, and you negotiate with right owners to acquire the rights of books so you can put them in to essentially public domain status, but you pay for the work. Another one would be to a similar mandate that research institutes that are subsidized by the federal government resource open journals. People have explored procurement mandates regarding to education materials or to build open databases, open software, or open course materials. There's a proposal that several people, including ourselves, have worked on about a WTO agreement on the supply of public goods so people could make binding offers in the context of the WTO, similar to the WTO agreement on services, to provide the supply of public goods. And once those agreements were made, in a heterogeneous set of public goods, they would become binding. And there's also a proposal that will be introduced in the Congress on an open source dividend that would reward people that openly share research findings with a percentage of the rewards that go to people that develop pharmaceutical drugs, so that people would have an economic incentive to publish in open journals and to put databases into the public domain and things like that, because they would be eligible for a reward fund that would recognize the importance of those contributions to development of new products to encourage more access to knowledge in the context of drug development. Finally, I have 2 points on international negotiations. The cross-border movement of works made accessible for persons with disabilities is a real problem. In the United States, we have the largest collection of English-speaking books that are accessible for people who are blind or have other disabilities. We don't share them with Canada. We don't share them with UK. We don't share them with Kenya. We don't share them with Jamaica. We don't share them with any country outside the United States. And most of those countries don't share them with us. In Latin America, you have countries that have tens of thousands of works accessible in Spanish language formats. You have countries that have less than 500 books available for people who are blind, which is a human tragedy that is not necessary. It's because of this sort of failure of the international economy to really pay much attention to this problem. There's a negotiation at WIPO, but there's no proposal so far in the United States Congress or by the Obama administration to change U.S. law in this regard. Finally, let's see, WIPO negotiations and copyright limitations and exceptions. There's a fairly significant negotiation going on at WIPO on copyright limitations and exceptions. It started 2 years ago. One issue that we've encouraged them to look at is to revisit the Berne Appendix, which is about half the text of the Berne Convention. And it's a largely forgotten instrument that failed. It was negotiated in 1971. And it came about because of a request in 1959 by the United States government and UNESCO. It started off the work program that led to this, essentially to this instrument. And I think that we're quite interested in looking at what can be done to kind of modernize, revitalize, and actually make that work in an environment where developing countries are having a lot of pressure on them to actually enforce copyright in those countries of low incomes. Finally, with regard to orphan works, I think the solution in the United States should not be one that requires remuneration for all works when the owners cannot be located. The proposals in the previous Congresses would not have done that. I think that was the right approach. Other countries have pursued a different approach where remuneration is made whether or not the authors can be located. And then in the international negotiations, I call attention to the fact that the text on damages in the ACTA text is inconsistent with the proposals that passed the Senate in the previous Congress on orphan works, and that we would that's, I think, highly problematic for liberalizing access to orphan works. We've called this attention to everyone we can find in the executive branch, and we've been actually talking to them for about 2 years about this problem. So it's not something that was a lack of information, but it's a disappointment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.